The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. You know, this show is turning out to be so much more interesting and exciting and informative than I had even hoped in the beginning. And it's beginning to dawn on me what's really going on here. We are going to be listening week by week to some of the very best people in America and around the world who care about other human beings, how to help people, how to grow, how to solve serious life issues. People who think in human terms rather than traditional psychiatric diagnostic medication terms. And as we build up our archives, we're going to have a record for anyone to turn to that will really be an updating into the most modern knowledge that we have about psychological and spiritual growth. The show is booked up already with just marvelous presenters, marvelous guest speakers, and I guess just plain old friends and guests who really want an opportunity like this to communicate with you around the world about the really best and most helpful approaches to dealing with life. We've changed, or I would say expanded, the concept of our organization, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, to the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living, Empathic Living. And that's a lot about what today's program is going to be about. My guest today is Joanne Cacciatore, Ph.D., Joanne is an astonishing human being. She experienced severe loss, which she will tell you about. And after struggling through psychiatry and its machinations, which were less than helpful to her, she rose above it and beyond it to go on to create a network of people devoted to helping with bereavement, especially with the loss of a child, which can be the most devastating loss that a human being goes through. And with that brief introduction and a mention of one of her books, which is Dear Cheyenne, which you can get on Amazon.com as well as on Joanne Cacciatore's website, I want to introduce Joanne. Hi.
Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're coming across loud and clear, too, and it's really an honor to have you on. You are going to really contribute to the understanding of how to handle, essentially, life, and in many cases, life at its toughest. Could you begin, Joanne, and just tell us a little bit about what you went through that led you to become a world expert in trauma and loss?
Yes, certainly. In 1994, I experienced the death of my fourth child, a baby. They were unable to find a cause of death, and I left the hospital within just a few minutes after her death, and went home without having really any psychosocial support, no intervention, no follow-up care. They just let me leave the hospital, and I was ill-prepared. I had no idea. When you suffer such a traumatic loss, you can't begin to imagine what it's going to feel like in 1 week or 3 months or 1 year. And so I began a downward spiral into a really, really dark place. where I lost a great deal of weight and was having difficulty functioning. I had three young children at home. I wasn't able to tend to their emotional, social, spiritual, or physical needs because I could barely tend to my own. And I thought, this is crazy that we have, the most common human experience, that is death, guaranteed for all of us, and the resultant grief, and we don't have any structure in place to proactively intervene for families in a compassionate way. I did seek psychotherapeutic intervention after her death. However, I went to three or four, I think, different counselors or psychotherapists, and many of them wanted to send me to psychiatrists who then wanted to medicate me. And I can remember specifically telling one of the psychiatrists, I'm not taking anything. I have earned every single tear I shed. And this pain and her life is worthy of all of my tears. And so I refused medication, and it was very, very painful, and it was very, very difficult. And I came out the other end and feel that because I was able to experience it in full, as Marcel Proust says, in order to endure a suffering, we must experience it in full, that is the nature of life. Life is painful sometimes. So I founded the organization several years later because I was alone after her death and really didn't have any proactive support. And I founded the organization with the idea that we would promote counseling, advocacy, research, and education for families experiencing child death. And that's what we've done. We have 77 chapters now around the world, including Romania and Paraguay, which is just fascinating to me that since 1996, we've been able to grow this organization.
Now tell the name of the group. I don't think you've actually mentioned it.
It's called the MISS Foundation, M-I-S-S Foundation.
And how do people get to it?
MISSFoundation.org, MISSFoundation.org. And there, if you go into, if for people who are looking for support, they can go to the National Chapter Locator where it will tell, all the different chapters that are around the U.S. and the world.
That's an incredible feat. It's a testimonial both to your abilities and to just how much need there is out there for caring counseling. Now, yes. You got almost stuck in the psychiatric system, but you never did succumb and take medication?
That's correct. I never, for me, it wasn't the answer. Intuitively, I knew that this was something I had to feel. I wanted it to be authentic, an authentic grieving experience, because really her life was worth it to me. It seemed so appropriate that I was feeling so much pain because I loved her so much. And to try and numb that pain or to try and assuage that pain inauthentically, in a sense I felt was not respectful in my own way for me of the love that we shared. I wanted it to be intense grief because it was intense love. And I felt like that was what was ultimately going to heal me. And it did.
Now, how far into the pregnancy did you deliver your child?
Yes. She died actually during birth on her due date. She was about 15 minutes from birth. So she was 8 pounds, 22 inches long. I was having natural childbirth, as I did with all my children. They lost her heartbeat, and there was talk about a crash cesarean section. Very, very traumatic. When your contractions are coming every 15 to 30 seconds and they last for a minute or 2 minutes, it's hard to think through what they're telling you when they say, we think the baby just died.
Oh my God. It's just hearing about it is incredible. I want to talk about a few different things here, and I know that you do too. Before getting into your recovery, let's underscore what ordinarily happens to somebody under these conditions. Now we have Congress passing laws that will require health agencies to do a mental health screening for an ordinary delivery for the parent postpartum.
Right.
And, of course, in your case, they would have caught you right away. And that would have meant you would have gotten a diagnosis of postpartum depression or major depressive disorder in response to the death of your infant. And yeah. that would have set a whole set of processes in line, because after all, this is psychiatry. This is postpartum depression, or this is major depressive disorder. And you would have been automatically pushed into taking medication. And so yeah. it's especially wonderful to have you talking here about how you knew that wasn't the right way.
Right.
How did you intuit that, or how did you learn that wasn't the right way, that you needed to struggle with your tears and your loss?
I'm not sure, because I actually was born into a fairly avoidant Sicilian family, so I wish I could give you some profound piece of wisdom. I just know that I was very much identified with my role as a mother, and I practice attachment parenting with all of my children. That was very, very important to me. I breastfed them all for several years and had natural childbirth, and so I was very in touch with my children. And so the loss of one of my children for me was probably the worst suffering that I could endure. I can remember going to the different psychotherapists who were supposed to be experts, quote, experts in this field, and I really felt, this kind of sense of not knowing what to do and wanting to cure me of this, as if I was mentally ill, as if I had an illness that they could cure, that they could, and really, the only way that they could have cured me was if they could have brought my daughter back from death. And if they couldn't bring her back from death, then there was no cure. All I really wanted was someone to sit in my suffering with me, with someone to join me in the abyss and say, I can't fix this for you, but I will suffer with you. I will go through this with you, and you don't have to do it alone. And I never got that. I never got that from really anyone in my life. No one in my life was willing to be fully present with the dark emotions with me. And that's a tragic thing, because, if you look back throughout history, the great mystics, right, St. John of the Cross, Teresa Avila, some of the great mystics talk about the necessity of that darkness, of being with your dark emotions in order to live more fully, that's what contributes to a fulfilled and joyful life, is being able to tolerate our negative emotions, right?
Yes, and how much of a role did Christianity or spirituality play in your recovery?
Oh, that's a really great question, and I'll tell you why it's a really great question, because I was an atheist at the time my daughter died.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. So talk about being in a really dark place. I remember when they were putting her, it was August 1st of 1994, and they were putting her little pink satin casket into the ground, and I literally lunged toward it, into the hole. Because I had this thought, as an atheist, I'm never going to see her again. I there's no hope for me that I will ever see her again. I still, God and I are still involved in this little tug of war thing, because I'm a scientist. I'm a professor at Arizona State University, and I'm a researcher, and so I'm hyper analytical. So I still have this tug of war thing with God, because, that faith is one of those things that's difficult to quantify. And yet at the same time, I do believe that her death has led me to a profoundly spiritual place in my life where I accept that there's no, for me, I believe there's no possible way I could have gotten through this alone without some extraordinary supernatural help.
Well, I have grown more and more in that direction with you, and I think of myself as just constantly asking God's permission to walk with Him and in the strength of God and of a loving God. I think that's one way that obviously I differ from a lot of very scientifically oriented people, and it's a struggle for us. I sometimes think that God gave me a particular challenge, which was to be the hard scientist who could refute modern biological psychiatry, and He sort of held in abeyance my spirituality until I had affirmed my identity of hard scientist, critical of biological psychiatry, and then I was given the opportunity to learn more about my real self.
Yes.
So tell me some more about your experience and your growth through this experience. How much of a role did your decision to become proactive in the world about bereavement? How much did that participate in your healing?
Oh, it tremendously. I mean, I tell all of our parents. I mean, one of the cornerstone principles of the Miss Foundation is, you know, when you're ready, give back and take your hand and reach out to another, because I believe and the neuroscience research is supporting this. I mean, research on telomeres and you know, the changes in the brain that can occur as a result of altruism suggests that service to others is really one of the most profound ways to help. I mean, this is a very Frankelian idea, right, from Man's Search for Meaning, the idea of, you know, meaningful service to another, that's the only way to true happiness in life is to help others. So that's why, I think that's one of the reasons also why our organization has grown so exponentially, because we give people a safe place to be bereaved without time limits. I mean, we recognize the interminable aspects of parental bereavement. So we give them the safe place to be bereaved as long as they need. And then when they're ready, that they can find a way to channel their talents into helping others. And that's a really powerful experience. And we're a volunteer-run organization. So, I mean, we have tens of thousands of volunteers around the world. This is really a phenomenal organization that's financed by love and compassion and kindness. And that's the most powerful of all, really, when it comes down to it. The economics of love, compassion, and kindness, that's what drives this organization.
And that's what drives the good life, I think, for all of us. We struggle to walk with God in that regard, but I think that is the essence of the good life. Let me remind folks, if they missed it, that you are listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and my guest, my marvelous guest, is Joanne Cacciatore. Joanne's a PhD and has set up a worldwide organization for helping people with bereavement. You can find out more about Joanne by going to our organization, of which she is a part, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. And you can find that at empathictherapy.org. And just click on the link to the advisory council and spin down to see, and you'll find Joanne Cacciatore there. A couple of things that occurred to me, Joanne, as you were talking. First, this is a show for everyone who cares about human life, and you made a passing reference that I want to clarify. You mentioned Frankelian viewpoint, and I'm sure you were referring to Viktor Frankl, who,
yes.
I just wanted to tell folks, was a psychiatrist who lived through the Holocaust and wrote a wonderful book. Can you remind me the name of the book, The Meaning of Life
Search,
or something?
Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning, a book that had a big influence on me back in the 50s when I was a young student reading some of the most important books. And Frankl describes how he got through the Holocaust, and in part by remembering his love for his mother, as I recall.
Yes, yes.
And we come back to these very basic things that are a part of all religion, and I believe should be a part of all good psychology, which is service to others, caring for others, putting oneself in the shoes of others. It's a quality if you're going to be a parent, a friend, a therapist, or be in therapy. It's, I think, the deepest, most complex part of human existence, this learning to put oneself in the shoes of others, which to me is essentially an aspect of love.
Yes, indeed. And you're right. The wisdom traditions, all the major wisdom traditions of the world, you know, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Islam, all of the major religions talk about service in one way or another, and, you know, different vernacular, but it's all about serving others, and that's really where I think that's where human beings find their sense of purpose and meaning in the world, and can grow and flourish. I don't know that we will be able to fully experience joy that's sustained and authentic without serving others.
I think that's absolutely true. It's either been given to us by God or by evolution or by both. I don't think it's a contradiction.
Yeah.
That human beings yearn for spiritual meaning, and they yearn to be of service to other human beings.
Yes.
And those who seek service rather than giving service always end up feeling like victims and feeling vulnerable. The answer to life is not what you can get from others. It's clearly what we give to other people. And, you know, not just other people, but to nature. I mean, to gardens, to
yes.
the forest, to the birds, to our
yes.
pets,
yes.
To in our creativity, what we give through music or art or literature.
And to ourselves, right, Peter?
Talk about that.
Well, I mean, I think self-care is really important. I'm often approached by physicians, nurses, social workers, and even sometimes rarely, but sometimes psychiatrists and mental health providers who say, you know, how can I be the best caregiver to a bereaved parent or a bereaved family? And one of the pieces of that puzzle is taking care of the self, and that is taking care of your own self emotionally and psychologically, physically, spiritually, whatever that means to you, and that can apply to secular humanists as well, and socially. I mean, we need to take care of ourselves in order to be able to take care of others. That mindfulness with the self is really, really important. And we're learning that more and more. I mean, practitioners who tend toward vulnerability of vicarious trauma are the ones in general who are not taking good care of themselves or who are not prepared, particularly in my field, to deal with death. So what we see is physicians, for example, who have high death anxiety, who don't tolerate their own, quote, negative emotional states well, also don't take care of their patients as well and are not as empathic with their patients.
Well, I think that is so true that there's hardly words for it. I know when I was a young therapist, I got to believe that there was technology and these therapeutic approaches and all this stuff. I kind of lost track of what I initially learned working in the state mental hospitals as a college kid, which is that caring about suffering human beings was the single most important thing that you could contribute to them. And we were getting people out of the state hospital as college volunteers that the psychiatrists and all their wisdom thought were lost causes. And then I kind of lost a little track too during my training. I had sort of debriefed myself from my training to really get back to what really mattered. And what I learned from my patients in the early years, my clients, was that my caring about them helped them care about themselves and was the beginning
yes.
of their recovery
yes.
from whatever it was that they were struggling with. I mean, that was the beginning. That was the foundation stone, was my caring enough about them for them to care about themselves.
Yeah, that's a powerful gift, isn't it?
It is. And it's, you know, it's hard for men. It's hard for professionally trained men. It's hard for all of us. But those of us trained as physicians and psychiatrists, I think, are the most handicapped in the world to take on this challenge. So it's a marvel that any psychiatrists are seeking your help, and I hope more and more will seek our help. And, of course, I speak as a psychiatrist in saying how handicapped we are in reaching this kind of capacity to care about others.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us more about your organization and what you're doing and what you're hoping to accomplish with folks.
Oh, well, we do so much. We offer clinical counseling through the Center for Loss and Trauma. And we have, you know, clinical counseling for families. It's green mental health. We don't refer people out for medications. We sit with them. We don't have an agenda. Our only agenda is to help families who are experiencing the impending death or the death of a child at any age and from any cause to help them feel well supported through what's life's worst, you know, traumatic experience for a family to lose a child. And so, so counseling is a huge part of what we do. We do a lot of advocacy work. We are involved in legislation that's been passed in 27 states, compassionate care type legislation for families. We support research. I publish in top-tier peer-reviewed journals. You know, my research on psychosocial care and intervention for families, ritualization, anything having to do with the death of a child is what I research and study on. In fact, colleagues and myself have just launched a study called the TEAR Study. People, if they're interested in participating, they can go to tearstudy.org. And it stands for Traumatic Experiences and Resiliency Study, and we're looking at, you know, the psychological, social, spiritual, and economic effects of traumatic child death in families. So that's the research piece, and then the final piece is education, and we're committed to speaking out, to educating not just caregivers and providers, but academics, families, family members, policymakers. We're very, very involved in our communities. And, for example, our Romanian chapter, in Romania, the way that bereaved parents are treated is shocking, frankly. Parents are, in general, not recognized. They are not considered what they want to do in terms of final disposition, often is not considered. The state often takes power away from the families and makes those kinds of decisions. And so we have an activist there, Bianca Brad, who runs our Romanian group, and she's really working with some of our volunteers here in the States to help restructure and educate some of the caregivers and some of the systems. It's a systemic problem, right? So the systems at the macro level are in charge, and we're trying to reverse that power. We're trying to give power back to the individuals, to the families who are experiencing these tragic losses. So really the four cornerstone principles are counseling, advocacy, research, and education, which of course is the acronym CARE. And that's really what it comes down to, is can we create a more sane and compassionate society for parents who are bereaved?
We're experiencing a tremendous response to our new Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, and you're joining us as a part of that wonderful response we're getting. I think there's something going on out in the universe now that is recognizing more and more this issue that, of course, I've been banging my head against literally since I was a teenager working in the state mental hospitals at Harvard, this issue of that biological theories and practice and drugs and shock treatment are simply not the answer, and that empathic caring approaches are the answer. I'm getting a sense that people are realizing that more and more right now. Are you getting that same sense?
I am getting that sense. I mean, there's still quite a bit of resistance because we know that kind of you know, attitudinal change doesn't happen overnight. But I think that there are some very important people who are starting to pay attention to this message. And the message is that it may seemingly take more time, at least in the short term, and more effort, if you will. You know, the brief laconic treatments of psychiatry, certainly at least on the surface, seem to be a more expedient path toward, quote, recovery. You know, my hypothesis is actually that costs us more in the end, considerably more in the end, in terms of human and economic loss, for that matter. I think and I feel that this is a really, really critical point for people who are at all on the fence, not just to listen right to the common sense, because the common sense is we need human beings. William James said to be alone is one of the greatest evils for a person. I mean, we need other human beings to join us in our suffering.
Yes.
But at the same time...
We're going into break now. You're listening to Joanne Cacciatore, who has just said that being alone is just about the worst thing a human being can endure. And we'll come back and talk about that some more.
You're listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, this is Eric Ochsner, your host of the best jazz show on the air. On Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
I'm Elaine Snuffa, host producer of Evolving Ideas, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Welcome back to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, and to my astonishing, outstanding guest, Joanne Cacciatore. I'm just very honored to have her on the show today. The work that you're doing, Joanne, is just incredible.
Thank you.
It's very, very, very important work. And it just, again, makes me proud to be having this show where we're going to be archiving, just the best there is out there in the world now of human growth. I hate to call it even mental health, but of human growth.
Yeah.
When I was a young man and I would get up and give a talk on why drugs were not the answer and why shock treatment was an abomination and nothing more than an electrical lobotomy. Sometimes somebody would stand up in the back. Didn't happen much anymore, but somebody would stand up in the back of the room and say, "Well, have you ever been depressed? You know, what do you know? Have you ever been unable to get out of bed?" As if that would justify the drugs and the shock treatment. And I remember that I would just suck it up and I'd say, imagine being about as depressed as you can. I know about that. Imagining being as lonely as you can. I know about that. Imagine the worst you can. I know about that. And that's why I know that drugs and shock aren't the answer, that there are better ways to become a happy, thriving, a human being. And I'm so glad you began our hour talking about that you were in this deep, black, dark, lonely place, and that you found your way out despite the offers of psychiatry, which you rejected. And I just want to say that I'm just really, I'm really grateful that you're willing to share that with our audience, because I think it's so incredibly important for people to realize that, in fact, the more despairing you are, the more you need a psychological and spiritual solution, and the more you'll be injured by taking psychiatric drugs or submitting yourself to shock treatment, because your resources have gone thin at the time when you're feeling so down and out. Now, of course, if you're on psychiatric drugs, it's also dangerous to rush into stopping them. So I'm not advocating that anyone rush into stopping them. And if you look at my two most recent books, each of them has a chapter at the end about the need for caution and clinical supervision and coming off of drugs. Those books are Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition, and Medication Madness, which came out about a year or so ago. And Joanne is the author of Dear Cheyenne, which you can get, as you can get any of my books, on Amazon.com. How do you feel about going back and just talking a little bit more about how it's the depths of despair are not the point at which you need drugs and shock treatment and a diagnosis?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as you're just kind of discoursing there, Peter, I was thinking about, I can't imagine, had I acquiesced and accepted the course of treatments that were being offered to me at that point in my life, I can't imagine where I would be today. I cannot imagine that I would have come through to become the person I have become today. I mean, in 16 years since my daughter's death, you know, I founded an international organization for parents who are bereaved. I went back to school. I finished baccalaureate studies, master's studies, my PhD program, you know, while raising a family. And I do have a subsequent child who was born 3 years after Shai's death. I cannot begin to fathom, you know, what place I would be in today had I not gone the honest course, my course, not someone else's course for me, because they were uncomfortable, you know, with my emotions, but my true course. So I think back, you know, if I go back to 1994, I mean, I was in a really, really dark place, but I got to tell you what exacerbated the darkness for me was the sense of aloneness in the world. And before the break, I was talking about William James, who said to be alone is one of the greatest evils for a person. And it truly, truly is. That sense of aloneness in the world, the sense of no one is willing to join me in my suffering, people don't want to hear about it. I mean, people go back to life as normal. You know, a month after a child dies in a family, everyone kind of goes on with life, and they give you a month. What you get, you might get a week off work if you're lucky, but they give you about a month to mourn, and then that's all. That's all you get, and then you have to be, you know, the same person you were before. And I tell people my life is divided into two parts: before her death and after her death. I am not the same person. It changed me forever. And that's okay. That's okay, because I've not only returned to my level of functioning where I was before she died, but I've transcended that. And I've transcended that because I did it authentically. I did it authentically. And for me, that was the right way. So, you know, so I'm glad that I rejected psychiatry's overtures and decided to do it my own way. Was it painful and difficult, and did I suffer? Absolutely. Have there been consequences for that? Yes, absolutely. That's life. You know, when you're born into this world, you don't get a free pass to enjoy life every minute of every day. It's not always joyful. There is suffering with life. That's part of being human. It's part of the human experience. And the quicker we realize that, and the more willing we are to sit with our own emotional states that can be distressing and despairing, then the better we get at it. I call it, you know, kind of, you know, building up the muscle of grief. You know, when you lift a weight, that's 50 pounds and you lift it the first time, it's intolerably difficult to lift it, but you keep doing it over and over again, and pretty soon you're doing it with very little effort, and that's because you've grown the muscle. It hasn't, the weight hasn't changed, but you've changed in response to that weight. And I think that's a crucial point for people to remember, that that life is suffering, that from the time a little child is young, they will experience losses in life. Use those losses as an opportunity to teach them and grow with their own tolerance of their emotional states, you know, rather than when the goldfish dies, rather than, oh, let's go get a new goldfish. I mean, allow them to be sad. Allow them to sit with the sadness. Sit on the couch with them. Make some hot chocolate. Put your arm around them. Sing with them. Mourn with them. Those are really important aspects of being human that I think we all too often in our very fast-paced, avoidance society that we forego.
You're listening to Joanne Cacciatore, Ph.D., on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Joanne, you're saying so much that is important, and you're doing such a nice job of showing that whether you're a parent or a counselor or a friend, professional or just an intimate, that the same principles apply. One of the things that I teach students when I'm helping them understand how to help other human beings is to welcome suffering.
Yeah.
Don't think that suffering is to be run from. Don't let it scare you. Understand that suffering is an expression of a deep love of life, that a person's intensity of suffering reflects the intensity of their disappointment, their hurt, and their involvement with life. That far worse than deep suffering is indifference, which doesn't bear the suffering and allow you to go through the process. And even when you're a therapist and someone is suicidal, you want to hear about it, you want to share it, and you will find the miracle that occurs when you really want to hear about what another human being is going through, whether it's your child or your husband or your wife or your friend or your client. And we live in this abominable situation now where psychiatry has sold to people the idea that suffering is a disorder and that you want to drug the suffering. Literally now, if you go to see your local psychiatrist, and indeed your pediatrician, your obstetrician, your family doctor, your physician's assistant, your nurse practitioner, and you tell this person nowadays about a painful feeling, you won't get more than 30 seconds out before they're going through their internal file card of what drug should I give for this painful emotion. And it's such a backward attitude, a caring approach to suffering that welcomes it, that lets you know that this is a normal reaction to what you're going through. Normal reaction of a normal person with a normal brain to trauma, loss, and suffering. That can so help a person get through it. And it's just marvelous to hear you, Joanne, creating an international organization which is going to help people understand this.
Yeah, it's worthy. I mean, it concerns us as an organization. It concerns us a lot, this new kind of unfolding of the pathologization of bereavement. So this treatment of bereavement as a pathology, as a mental illness, which is, you know, of course, the DSM-5, we've heard a lot about.
No, you need to tell people, because this is a general audience. They might not even know what the DSM-5 is, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it's the planned new fifth edition. And Joanne, you can tell them what they're planning to do with that.
Well, my understanding, I haven't actually read it in black and white, but my understanding of the DSM-5 is that there will be a 2-week period post-bereavement, and past beyond the 2 weeks, symptoms of grief will be diagnosed or diagnosable by a psychiatrist as major depressive disorder.
That's a travesty against the human spirit, and that's my understanding, too, of what's going to go on. It will simply formalize what psychiatry and those who practice drug prescribing across the board are already doing, which is to give you a pill at the funeral, if not on the day of your loss, so that you can't
happening.
Even go through the natural bereavement experience.
Absolutely, Peter. I mean, that's happening right now. We're seeing that in our research. I see it anecdotally at the clinical office. I'm working on a paper that's a case series, and I'm seeing that right now with a good majority of our patients, particularly are coming in having been prescribed a combination SSRI, certainly benzos, sometimes antipsychotics, the day of their child's death, before they've even left the hospital. They have a cocktail, and this is problematic. This is problematic ethically. This is problematic. You know, these aren't even being prescribed by psychiatrists primarily. They're being prescribed by emergency room physicians, general physicians, obstetricians are particularly known for this at this point. This is what we're seeing. This is the trend, and it's really disconcerting.
I think problematic comes from your being at the university, but part-time at a university. I see it as a crime against the individual, and I'm sure you feel that underneath, that these are spiritual crimes to drug and shock. And we have a lot of electroshock going on, and particularly elderly women who have so many reasons to be sad in our culture. We have so much of this going on. It really is a crime against the human spirit.
Well, and
again,
so is the whole so is the whole arrogance of you know, being able to call someone majorly depressed 2 weeks after. I mean, I have a family I'm working with who lost their 15 and 17 year old beautiful, beautiful children in a terrible, tragic car crash. I'm giving them 2 weeks before I tell them that they're depressed. That's not for me. That's never going to work for our population. And I hope that all clinicians who are listening to this, when they're working with bereaved parents, have the prudence and the ethics to forego what the system is telling them and do what their heart and their rational mind tells them. Because anyone who's a parent, just entertain for just a moment what it would be like to put your child, you know, 6 feet into the ground and know that you will never see them on this earth again, and then tell me that could classify as depression.
Well, and I believe, I'd be interested in what your feeling is about this, that all human suffering has a cause and a reason behind it. And you're working in an arena where the cause is most obvious, the death of a child.
Right.
But everyone who feels depressed has reasons. They may be harder to get to. They may come out of abuse experienced as a child.
Certainly.
They may come out of an unfulfilling marriage. They may come out of unfulfilled hopes for work. They may come out of spiritual emptiness. They may come out of innumerable kinds of human disappointment, loss. And the principles that Joanne Cacciatore is talking so eloquently about today in regard to her special area, bereavement, I believe, and I imagine you believe too, Joanne, apply to all human suffering.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I at least in my practice, and I've been around for a long time, meeting with people, meeting them where they are. If I meet someone and they tell me, well, I have some depressive symptoms, these are not necessarily bereaved parents. If you explore and if you're willing to sit with them long enough and really let their life story unfold, there's always something underneath the surface, at least in my experience, that kind of generalized, even the generalized ennui, is incited by something deep within them. It may stem back from childhood, you know, in a Freudian or Jungian sense, or it may be, you know, something more contemporary, like you said, a marital issue or spiritual crisis. I mean, we search for meaning. We want purpose in life, and how many of us have truly found our calling?
I so much believe in a calling. You know, I think we do walk with God, whether we know it or not, and that there are purposes for us. And I would urge anyone listening and thinking about these issues to get familiar with what your purpose is. Why are you here? One of the first places to look for your purpose is to look at what your skills are. What are your gifts? What are your interests? Where does your mind naturally go to when you think about doing something worthwhile? It can be in some heavy-duty activity like Joanne is talking about, but it can be in some other activity where your purpose is, where you'll bring joy to yourself and others through entertaining people, through making people happy. Somewhere, each of us has gifts, has purpose, has something that we can contribute to in this world. And finding that and pursuing that and not being discouraged in pursuing that is a huge part of the good life. And it can be loving your husband or loving your wife. It can be raising your children. It can be taking care of animals. You can be a rescue person for animals. Whatever it is that you love, that you're gifted at, treasure it, grow it, really believe in it. It's one of the great secrets to living a good life as well as to overcoming some of the toughest things that life will throw at us. Joanne, your thoughts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think what you're talking about are those kind of innate gifts that we all have, those passions that we have, and finding our passion and following that is crucial. I mean, this is not just for bereaved parents, obviously. That's when I was talking earlier and talking about the cornerstone principle of our organization being service and giving back. People come back to us and say, now what can I do for the organization? And my question to them is, where's your passion? What do you love? What do you love to do? What fills your soul? And it may be directly helping other parents, and so in that case, they're assigned to be a hope mentor, and they're trained to be a hope mentor, and a hope mentor stands for helping other parents endure, and so they become like a peer contact for that other parent, for new parents coming into the organization. It may be something administrative. Maybe their passion is more creative or artsy, so we have a mom who tragically lost her 9-month-old baby, and she makes beautiful cards for our organization so that they're remembrance cards so that we can send them out to families on the anniversary of their child's death. And that's her passion. She's very artistic that way, and I'm not. So what's your passion? What's your talent? And making the best of what we have and focusing on what we do have when we're ready, rather than our deficits. It's absolutely true. I mean, I think that's one of the great challenges that presents itself to us as a human being is can we manage our own sense of purposelessness in life when we come to that point when we realize, you know, so for some people it's in their 20s, some people it's in their 30s, for some people it's a little older, but when people come to that kind of place of existential crisis, if they haven't had a reactive sadness to an event yet, and it's just kind of this generalized melancholia, as Freud might call it, do we have the capacity to see within ourselves what our strengths are and then draw from our strengths?
You are so on target from my viewpoint. One of the things that I find devastating to children in our current society is, as you referred to, the emphasis on the deficits. I see little 10-year-olds brought in by their parents who supposedly have a deficit in executive functioning because psychologists have learned they can make a living doing that, defining executive function deficits. Well, they have an attention deficit or this deficit, and that's how the parents have been taught to think of the child. It's how the child thinks of themselves, and I say, forget it. Tear up all this neuropsychological testing. Forget about all your child's supposed deficits. Your child will succeed in life to the degree that he or she finds her gift, whatever it is, and expresses it and lives by it. They will give to the world. They will succeed in the world. It is ridiculous to be emphasizing our child's deficits. It all grows out of drug companies and organized psychiatry wanting to get a hold of folks to diagnose them and drug them. It's totally the wrong approach. Look for what's good in you, good in your children, good in your family, good in the world, and do everything in your power to bring it forth. I tell young therapists to bring out the best in yourself so you can bring out the best in others. And it's wonderful to have you on the show and in the world and a part of our organization. Again, Joanne Cacciatore. You can get to her, I'm sure, just by plugging Joanne Cacciatore into the Google mechanism, and you can get to her by going to the organization that my wife Ginger and I have founded, empathictherapy.org. You know, click on our advisory council, and you'll find Joanne Cacciatore listed there. Joanne, you're doing something that Ginger and I consider the most important aspect of reform in this whole area right now. You're actually developing ways of reaching out and helping people. What are you finding? First, are you finding that volunteers can counsel? Are you finding that you need a lot of training to counsel? What are you evolving? Because we're thinking more and more, we need a whole approach to who can counsel and to helping people learn to be counselors. Tell me your thoughts about that.
Well, the way our organization is structured, you know, we have support groups, which are run by parents who are bereaved, who do go through training. Then we have Hope Mentors, and they go through an extra level of training, and they provide one-on-one support. So I guess in a way they're counselors, but they're not clinically trained.
Well, exactly. So tell us, what is the training that takes someone who's essentially not a mental health person, what's the training you give them that enables them to counsel people in bereavement?
Well, the training that we give them is for all intents and purposes, based on a model that I proposed called ATTEND. And I'm actually writing about it now, so it'll be available via publication. But the ATTEND model stands for attunement, trust, therapeutic touch, egalitarianism, nuance, and death education. So we train people to, you know, be attuned to another's suffering, to be mindfully present with them. We teach how to build trusting relationships, the importance of therapeutic touch, the importance of egalitarianism, that is, we're not better than someone else. We don't know more than anyone else. We're egalitarian. We are on at the same level with everyone else, right? There's no power struggle here. Nuance speaks to kind of cultural idiosyncrasies, where people are culturally aware and culturally sensitive to differences, and when I say culture, I mean rich culture, right? Not just ethnicity or languages spoken, but, you know, socioeconomic status, political affiliation, you know, even in terms of nuance, even the cause and timing of the child's death becomes important, because sometimes in bereaved parent support groups, you find this kind of Olympics of grief, like my grief's worse than yours. And so we don't do any of that. We're sensitive to the nuance. And finally, death education, and that's continuing education. So we provide monthly teletrainings for our volunteers and facilitators. So that's the second level. And so we prepare them through basically that model. And then the top level is clinical. And there are people who need kind of extra clinical intervention. And sometimes there are people who have been on psychiatric medications and they're really struggling. Sometimes there are people who have not been on medication, but they have very little social support. Some people come to us 16, 20 years after the child's death, and they feel like they've been running from it, and it's time for them to be present with their child's death and really experience it for the first time, because it's impeded in their life. They've just been very, very avoidant, and they're ready now to experience it, and they want a clinician who's trained who can do that for them. And that's a little more complicated because, of course, you have 20 years of kind of an avoidant rather than approaching style. So we have these kind of different levels in our organization, and then, you know, we have different volunteers, and many of our clinicians are interns who are students of mine, or they are volunteers who give of their time at pro bono.
You have been listening to, as we draw to a close on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, to Joanne Cacciatore. And I've just been so pleased to have her on the show.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.